This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.
Are you there, Sam?
Yep, hang on, I'm just turning that on.
Is our guest ready?
Yep, I've got the music ready.
Can you hear me okay?
Yep, sounds great.
Cool. Otago Access Radio, in partnership with Otago Polytechnic, brings you Blowing Bubbles.
Blowing Bubbles brings you positive conversations with people in their bubbles around the world.
We're curious about how people are finding new ways of life, being and problem solving. Every Wednesday, the Sustainable Lens team of Samuel Mann and Mawira Karatai reach out from our bubbles to chat with interesting and positive people around the world.
Broadcast on Otago Access Radio, 105.4 FM in Dunedin, and streamed and podcast on oar.org.nz.
Bringing joy, connection, kindness and peace in all the days ahead.
Welcome to Blowing Bubbles. I'm Samuel Mann. I am joined today by Tim Lynch. We've been running a series on anger. That doesn't sound very appealing.
You make it sound somewhat cathartic there, Sam. The great outpouring of masculinity from us both.
Let's do a bit of a recap. So you are studying for your doctorate of professional practice.
I am. My doctorate is around the communication of climate change and the effects of carbon, particularly surrounding carbon on food, and how interventions that could take place within education and also within restaurants, etc. My structure for the doctorate is loosely around this idea. First phase being that of anger, second phase being that of hope, and the final phase being action. So hopefully by the time I get to the final of those three phases, I'll be able to sit here and I'll be able to explain the things that I am actually doing, rather than just reading about and talking to people about it.
It's an interesting distinction between anger and hope. We might come back to this when we're talking about hope, but I think that the people that you've been talking to so far are hopeful of change, because otherwise they wouldn't be doing it.
Absolutely, and like there's a lot of... They do overlap each other, and you could almost, if you want, put the phases of grief over there as well, if you wanted.
A couple of weeks ago, you talked with Kyle Mackies.
Yes.
The takeaway that you had from that was that societal change is a delicate thing.
It's a delicate thing, and at the same time, the inertia of the status quo is far harder to overcome than perhaps we think.
And that something about being uncomfortable.
Yeah, change is uncomfortable. It's difficult, uncomfortable, and it requires motivation. A willingness to change, if you will. You don't change by accident. It's not like putting your socks on in the morning and putting old socks on.
Then last week you talked with Rosemary Penwarden.
I did, and that was a fascinating conversation in itself as well, because that was framing some of the personal motivations. You know, what is it that makes someone want to go out and do this direct action, the idea of eco-anger, what that feels like, how that manifests itself. So Rosemary was really interesting. So this week I had the pleasure of being able to talk to Jen Olson, who also should, by rights, like Rosemary, be retired. And also, I felt that I should be having dementia tea with her as well. Lovely lady, articulate, intelligent, very passionate about what she does. Really, really interesting conversation.
Yes, it's Jen Olson. Jen, short for Jennifer. Brought up in the country, come from the west of England, so brought up in a small village called Colpit Heath. And Dad was a farmer, or came off the farm when I was about five, and decided that's not what he wanted to do. He wanted to go into building. I don't know why. He's never said. But, well, that's another long story. But anyway, Mum and Dad both really interested in nature and the wildlife locally, and Yeah, it was a beautiful rural sort of setting. We used to do country spotters, which was a thing that came from the Farmers Weekly. Dad always used to get all the farmers' stuff, you know. He was Young Farmer of the Year when he was younger. And, yeah, I can still remember doing the little books, and it had certain things to look out for in each season, and you went round the countryside and, you know, you got certain flowers and leaves and all sorts of things, and found out about laying hedges and local things that they do. So, yeah, and also I become very aware of social issues quite early also, because I sort of came back to environmental awareness through the political side. When I was at school, aged about 10, we had the centenary for our school, and we learned about the lives of kids 100 years ago, and that's when I found out that kids of my age 100 years ago had been sent down the coal mines to work. And I just thought to myself, no, that can't be right. And that kind of started me looking into, I suppose, or being interested in social history. And later on, when I started work, I joined the union and become aware of the union movement, all sorts of politics. Dad was a Tory, and I kind of went the opposite way and early become a socialist. And yeah, that led to endless arguments, actually. That's where I learned that you can't convert somebody through the logic of your arguments, because if that was possible, there wouldn't be any Tories. Doesn't make sense. For the majority of them, unless they're wealthy, it doesn't make sense. But they've just been convinced by the propaganda. That's what I believe, yeah.
So I had to pose the question, really. You know, when was it that you felt that you needed to have to act on climate change?
I mean, I've been aware of it for a long time. Become more involved in politics and sort of did a lot of campaigning around social justice issues. And then in 2010 or 12, I got involved in the anti-TPPA thing, because one day I saw an email or something came through saying, "Oh, there's going to be a march in Dunedin." But there were no further details there. So I got in touch with somebody I knew in another town who was interested in politics. And they said, "Oh, yeah, the guy who set that up has actually left now. We need somebody to organise for Dunedin. Like, can you do it?" Because they knew I was I was a member of the Alliance Party and done quite a lot of campaigning on other things. So I said, "Oh, all right then." So I got in touch with a few people and we managed to kind of get a couple of hundred together in the Octagon. Got a megaphone and said, "Oh, we don't like the TPPA, and this is why. You know about the TPPA, I assume." Yeah. And then it kind of went from there with that one, and it ended up being quite the marches we were having. The more I found out about it, the worse I realised the TPPA was. And it kind of made the link into the relationship between the problems with the climate issues and environmental issues and the politics of it, because then you could see how the corporations were influencing government policy and the crossover between policies that are being pushed by those corporations and the effect that all this is going to be having on the climate and how difficult it's going to make it to do anything about it. And that again has come to pass, because we're now stuck with various trade agreements with ISDS agreements in them, the investor state dispute settlement ones, where corporations can sue governments if governments pass laws that might impact on their profits. And that includes environmental protection. And because this is taking place in the background and never actually being openly stated or described, or not in the mainstream media anyway, like nobody even knows that is happening, which Jane Kelsey and others have called the chilling effect. And that's the chilling effect of these various pieces of legislation. And obviously Jane Kelsey has sort of documented how the national government under John Key passed many pieces of legislation which most people will never have heard of that actually support the neoliberal capitalist sort of structure in such a way that it makes it extremely difficult to make the sort of changes that we now know we need in order to tackle climate change.
By chilling effect, she's not talking about the climate calling. What does she mean?
No. So what Jane Kelsey is talking about in a paper that she's put forward, it's a chilling effect on governments to want to go after corporations that may have caused environmental degradation. Now, I'm going to read directly from the paper here. The foreign investor can directly enforce these guarantees against the host state and ad hoc international tribunals. These have been widely criticised as favouring investors, lacking precedents or appeals, and for conflicts of interest when the arbiters may be advocates for investors in other disputes. So effectively what Jane's saying in this paper is that what's happening at the moment with the Fast Track Bill is there is no transparency whatsoever, and it's far too opaque, and that in and of itself is not good for a democratic process.
So yeah, I mean, I could see that those that capitalist structure was actually causing a lot of social problems and, you know, inequality and poverty, but it is the same structure that is also causing the destruction of the environment and making it really difficult to bring about any changes that are now needed, yeah, to tackle climate change. Early 2000s onwards, I've just become more and more aware of that tangled web of social legislation and social practices, I guess, that have kind of led us to where we are today.
One of the things we have in New Zealand is that we're surrounded by nature. How can we have a problem when we're surrounded by so much nature in New Zealand?
Oh, we just look around and we assume that those things are being looked after, but no, they're not. You know, and those are only a tiny remnant of what was here. I mean, I was just listening on the radio on the way in to Ty Rafferty and the discussions there about how to manage forestry. And they're losing millions of tons of topsoil every year off of those slopes that have been deforested and now left covered in all that slash rubbish. But it's not just the slash itself, it's the actual topsoil that is going. I mean, and that's just an ongoing problem with this, with the whole way of looking at land as a resource to be exploited rather than something which is providing for us all and which we need to be looking after so that it can sustain us. It's just a different kind of attitude. I mean, we've had that attitude of exploitation in New Zealand, I would argue, from the earliest colonial days.
We've been talking about activists, activism. How does she see activism?
Yeah, well, I was curious about that as well, because one of the things about activism is how much of a part does it play in your personal identity and of a makeup of how you view yourself and your role within the world. So, I mean, so I simply asked Jen, you know, how has the role of activism, you know, changed within her life?
Well, basically, it's just become more and more of an important thing in my life. Become more of an overarching interest, really. You know, I mean, it's always sort of been there, and the interest has always been there. But now, like, most of my spare time is spent either reading information that is going to be useful, finding out more things, mixing with other activists, trying to build the movement, actually thinking and planning different actions that we can do. I don't know, that is it, really. I work as well. I do have a job, so all my spare time, I should say. We've recently been defending the case, the coal train case, and I mean, there is more work to be done on the whole coal train issue. Every day, a train load of coal of there's probably about 15 carriages with 500 tonnes in each of coal, goes from the mine at Takatimu in Southland up through on the southern line through Dunedin, spends a few hours in the yards at Dunedin, then on it goes to the Clandeboy Fonterra milk drying factory, which is near Temuka. So that coal every day goes up, and that is burnt by Fonterra to produce their milk powder product. And they've got, that's only one of several factories they've got in New Zealand that use coal to dry milk into milk powder for a low-grade food additive product that they then flog to China.
Now, I've got to kind of interject on this one a wee bit and do a little bit of a fact-checking, because it is true, the North Island does use gas for drying milk powder, while the South Island uses coal. Now, also, the idea of milk powder can also be seen as a very high-value food additive rather than being viewed as like a low-value commodity, especially when you consider a lot of the items that milk powder is used in are in fortified or in functional foods. As a product, it's high in amino acids, it's high in calcium, it's high in potassium, phosphorus and protein, which can make it an incredibly valuable food additive.
As a chef, how do you wade through that information, disinformation, misinformation in both directions?
With difficulty. It's a difficult... And then on top of that, you have to put this thing called the customer. And then on top of that, you then have to put this thing called economic feasibility and viability of a business. So there's a lot of factors to consider in this one. You know, and depending on which way you want to look at it, like every restaurant should be, you know, vegan. But that's not going to happen. That's just not the reality. For the majority of people, going out to a restaurant and having a large steak is a pleasure. It's something they look forward to. It's probably something they don't get to do very often. It's something that will highlight a very special occasion, such as a graduation, a wedding anniversary, something like that. So you don't want to prevent that. What it comes down to oftentimes from the chef's point of view is really good menu design, where the sort of enriched plant options are viewed as being as high a premium as a meat version of it. And so that's where the idea of menu design and also cooking techniques come into place. The thing about cooking a steak is it's pretty simple, particularly with modern technology we have at the moment. You can cook meat to within, you know, half a degree, so you can have it perfect. Vegetables, on the other hand, require skill, preparation, timing, and they're a lot harder to work with.
It was decided as a focus, Extinction Rebellion, as a group, said, right, okay, Extinction Rebellion are a group that really go for direct action, disrupting business as usual in order to draw people's attention to it and try and get some change. So we said, look, Kiwi Rail, who are owned by the government, a government which has signed the climate emergency, has agreed that there is a climate emergency, signed up to the Paris Agreement, but they are allowing KiwiRail to transport this coal daily, coal which we know, we now know, every thousand... No, I'm not sure how many, I can't remember the exact figures, it's gone out of my mind. Every so many tons that are burned will result in a death of a person between now and 2100. For every so many tons of carbon dioxide that are produced, one person will die from climate-related causes. And there's a scientist who has come out with this paper, which has been extensively peer-reviewed and now cannot be, like, dismissed, that says that this is true. So this was part of what came up in for the coal train case. But anyway, we thought, right, our direct action would be, we will stop that coal train. We will, halt it. People will lock themselves onto the railway track and jump onto the train itself so it can't move. And that will disrupt the business. And, you know, that's our action. So we did that. And that worked out, it was a good action. But of course, that didn't stop KiwiRail doing the coal. And so we'd also done other things like written to Kiwi Rail, contacted the union. Obviously, Fonterra had been tackled a number of times over it. Gone to David Clark, who was the Minister of State-Owned Enterprises at the time, and had a series of meetings and discussions with him about why a state-owned enterprise is doing this. Gone to Megan Woods, the Minister of Energy, had conversations with her about the use of coal. Every other sort of avenue, non-direct action avenue that we could do. And I actually presented evidence on this in the court. That was... But anyway, the coal train was stopped, I think, 5 or 6 times eventually. One time by youth, who were really active in the movement at the time, saying, like, we want to do something. And we were saying, oh, God, you know, about letting them do that. But we helped them, you know. And then it didn't go down well in the media because it was like, Extinction Rebellion, using children to stop the train. But it was them that wanted to do it, man. They really wanted to. But anyway, most of the time it was us. Well, it was us. And then finally it came to the case. And the other thing was, some people were saying, we've got to get arrested. We've got to go to court. We've got to make this into a bigger thing, you know. And the police, they had the tactic of just, like, waiting us out. The first time we stopped the train, we were there for, like, 6 or 8 hours. And the weather was like this. It was bloody awful. And there was a couple of them still holding out. And it was like, you know, I got off the railway track because I was actually part of the stopping of the train. And then the police came and they said, oh, come on, it's time to go. You have to get off or you'll get arrested. So I was standing on the side and there was a couple of them locked onto the track. And I was like, oh, for God's sake, we've had enough, get off. But no, they didn't want to. Eventually they did. But the last time anyway, we stopped the train across the level crossing, the one by the train station. So that was a bit more of a disruption than it had been previously. And it did end up with 8 people getting arrested. And so it took several years for the court case to come. And what we were trying to do was put forward... There were 2 defences because there were 2 lawyers. One was the right to protest, but the other was a defence of necessity. And that is, we're stopping this because we're trying to save lives. People are going to die because of the use of this coal. But the judge didn't... Well, it's not that he wasn't sympathetic to that view, but it wasn't supported by law, because for a defence of necessity, you have to be more specific about whose lives are going to be saved. And the piece of climate research, I mean, we had another climate expert who was one of the writers from IPCC reports and, like, a professor of many things, giving evidence, who was really good. And so the judge understood about the whole necessity to act, but like I say, yeah, the points of laws, we could only say that someone is going to die from climate related causes within this period of time, but obviously we can't say specifically who, we can't point to anyone particular or say, like, when it's going to happen. It's just because of the increase in carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. So yes, he couldn't support that defence of necessity, and everyone was found guilty of trespass and one of obstruction, and one had pleaded guilty to obstruction. We haven't got the sentences yet.
Let's take the first of your music choices. What have we got?
Well, it's been in the news lately, this sort of exodus which is happening to Australia at the moment, and at the same time we seem to be hurtling towards Christmas at this set kind of time of the year. So I thought we'd have a Christmas song. And this particular Christmas song is a bit of an Australian anthem. It's called How to Make Gravy, and it's by a guy called Paul Kelly. In the song, he mentions the date, the 21st of December, which has now in Australia become Honorary Gravy Day, which is just like a fantastic idea, really. To make it even better, this song has now been made into a movie, which I think is about the best thing ever. Now, he does talk about some of his recipes. Now, as a chef, I do have to take a little bit of exception to the idea of putting tomato sauce in gravy.
Hello, Dan. It's Joe here. I hope you're keeping well. It's the 21st of December. Now they're ringing the last bells. If I get good behavior, I'll be out of here by July. Won't you kiss my kids on Christmas Day? Please, don't let them cry for me. I guess the brothers are driving down from Queensland. Stella's flying in from the coast. They say it's gonna be 100 degrees, even more maybe. But that won't stop the roast. Who's gonna make the gravy? I bet it won't taste the same. Just that flour, salt, a little red wine. And don't forget a dollar for tomato sauce, for sweetness and an extra tang. And give my love to Angus and to Frank and Dolly. Tell them all I'm sorry. I screwed up this time. And look after Rita. I'll be thinking of her early Christmas morning when I'm standing in line. I hear Mary's got a new boyfriend. I hope he can hold his own. Do you remember the last one? What was his name again? What was his problem? He never did get Nina Simone. And Roger, well, I'm even gonna miss Roger. Cause there's sure as hell no one in here I wanna find. I pray the baby Jesus have a Merry Christmas. I'm really gonna miss it. All the treasure and the trash. And later in the evening, I can just imagine you put on Junior Mervin and push the tables back. And you'll dance with Rita. I know you really like her. Just don't hold her too close. So oh, brother, please don't stab me in the back. Oh, I didn't mean to say that. It's just my mind, it plays up. Multiplies each matter. Turns imagination into fact. You know I love her badly. She's the one to save me. I'm gonna make some gravy. I'm gonna taste the fat. I'm sorry. Yeah, I love her badly. Tell them all I'm sorry. Kiss the sleepy children for me. You know one of these days I'll be making gravy. I'll be making plenty. I'll pay them all back. I'll pay them all, 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 pay them all back.
We've had the, I've never had it before. I don't know why I've never had it before, but it was delicious. I've forgotten what it's called. Poached egg in a tomato reduction.
Oh, it's shishio. So nice. Delicious.
Why don't we have that all the time?
The world should eat that. It's just like perfect.
You're listening to Blowing Bubbles. I have with me our roving reporter, Tim Lynch, who has been off talking to various people. Today, he is talking with Jen Olson, who hasn't really talked about what she does as a protester or as an activist. What does she do?
Well, what doesn't she do? Now, this is one of the great things about doing postgraduate is you get to have great conversations with really, really interesting people and ask them questions that you never thought you would ask of someone who's just about to retire, such as, have you ever been arrested and can you talk about it?
Yeah, it was on telly, so it's no secret. So CLA, Climate Liberation Aotearoa, were a group that were formed as part of the A22 network, which is an international network of climate activist groups. And they kind of grew out of Extinction Rebellion, but just with a slightly different pattern of operation, because Extinction Rebellion became quite a big organisation in the end, internationally again. And they had originally hoped that by having large-scale sort of mass disruptions, like disruptions of traffic. I don't know if you know about the London one. They kind of all occupied the centre of London for several days, you know. And I suppose they also thought, which lots of us did, but we now realise is not the point at all, that if enough people point out to our leaders, so to speak, with inverted commas, you know, government, business, the corporations, whoever, what's happening with the climate, how urgent it is that we do something, and how many people want that to happen, that they would somehow see the light and actually do something. But that has proved not to be the case. They have ignored it because the force, the power of the corporations, the lobbyists, and also the inertia of the system that we live in, and the difficulty within our short-term political system of turning around and telling people, hey, sorry, you know, your lifestyle as you know it now is not sustainable, we can't continue like this. All those things kind of mesh together to mean that, no, our leaders have done nothing and things haven't changed. And so those tactics are not working as well. And the A22 network have gone for like more specifically disruptive actions, very focused ones. At first, when they come to New Zealand, we heard a talk from one of the guys that started it, Roger Hallam, who was one of the founders of Extinction Rebellion, who actually is now in prison in England for climate activism. But I thought, it's not going to work in New Zealand. It worked. But then a number of activists who I really respect and who are really strong in their beliefs went for it and said, yeah, we're going to do it. We're going to do it in New Zealand. We're going to set up a group and we're going to get organised. So I said, all right then. And so our first organised set of actions was in Wellington, and it was blocking motorways to just create traffic disruption, basically, and get publicity. And it really worked. We got the most coverage we've ever had for any actions, including the big Extinction Rebellion one of 2019, I think it was. Anyway, I glued myself to the motorway. That's why I got arrested with super glue. And it took them, half an hour to get me off, and the traffic was stopped by the terrace tunnel for all that time. So that worked as a disruption.
It makes me think about the things that I'm happy not to do. I'm happy not to go skydiving. I have zero desire to go skydiving. I'll happily swim offshore, isolated, and I know that's a scary, dangerous thing, but I'll happily not jump out of an aeroplane. I'll also happily not glue my hand to a motorway.
And on the list of questions that I never thought I would ask someone, this is up there. is super gluing your hand to a motorway scary?
You'd think it would be, but actually it is just before you get onto the motorway. But once you're on there, then, I don't know, no. That's it. You know you've done what you can. Then you just got to wait and see what happens. I don't know. Something like that. I mean, there was a point when I just, it did go through my mind, oh, I wonder if this was quite such a good idea. That's when I realised how hard it was going to be to get it off. Yeah. But
how do they?
using acetone. Acetone dissolves it. So they get acetone and they just slowly get it under your fingers, but you can't pull. I did lose a bit of skin, but not much. They were quite good with that. But it was actually St John's. They got St John's ambulance people to do that, to actually get the glue off. There was a couple of cops that were, you know, wanting to sort of hurry things up, but the St John's people were really good. And the cops that were there, I mean, initially they're like, what are you doing? Get off the road. Get off the road. And we said, no, can't. We're glued. And then once they'd understood what the situation was, they just dealt with it as it was. You know, they weren't overjoyed about it, but they weren't angry or obstructive or nasty and got put on bail. And so I did it, actually, then I went out, I think, a day or two later and did it again on bail. And then I did it again a couple of months later. But that time I got remanded in custody. So, yeah, I got 2 weeks, was 2 weeks remanded at Arahata Women's Prison before finally our lawyer, we got lawyers from Lawyers for Climate Action who were acting pro bono, which is amazing. But they, yeah, got us out after a couple of weeks on bail. So I'm still on bail now because the court cases haven't come up. They won't come up till next year. So it was last year that the actions were done. It's about a year ago now, roughly, I think. It was about a year ago, September, since that happened.
We talked a couple of weeks ago about 3.5% of the population needed to make a difference. Do we need more Jens and Rosemaries?
Yeah, and that's a really good point, because we need to make up that bell curve. We need to, you know, I believe, I should put a caveat in there, I believe that we need to even out the sort of apathy, if you want, of the middle of that bell curve. So, I mean, that is a question that I did have to pose to Jen. It's like, do you think New Zealand needs more direct action such as what you are doing?
That's what it's going to take. Yes, I believe that. Yes, I wish we could do it. Yes, I think it's necessary. I think if we're going to make the changes we need to avoid an absolute climate catastrophe, and I'm not exaggerating, that's what is coming. I know that is coming. Anyone who looks into it, you do. Anyone who looks into it knows that it's coming. That we've got to do whatever we can to disrupt business as usual and make them do something about it. We need thousands of people on the streets to do that.
Is that real? Have they stopped arresting protesters?
Well, there seems to be a lot of information floating around surrounding this stuff. I know one thing that's definitely happened is that the police in the Netherlands are taking a much more relaxed approach to protesters, simply because of the volume of people that are protesting. And what that's done is it's meant to sort of hit this tipping point politically where they're pushing towards that 3.5% change, which is starting to occur, which is really interesting.
I mean, the hope was, yes, that that would happen, that actually we would get enough people who were prepared to take action, that we could keep up the disruption until we actually got the change we wanted. I mean, there has been some examples of that overseas, but they did have to get quite a few people. I think it was the Netherlands. They got about 10,000 out, and they got legislation changed around oil exploration.
Tim, we were talking about the hyphenated activist, the academic activist, or the chef activist.
Do you think in our jobs we have space for doing this sort of work?
I'm not sure. I'm not sure how my employers would view it reflecting upon them if I chose to go to Wellington and protest, or if I chose to, when a cruise ship came into Port Chalmers, to go out there and protest at it. I'm not sure how they would view that. I know I'm allowed to. I know it's part of my civil right to, you know, to protest. I know that I'm allowed to. I often wonder, though, whether the kind of subtle undercurrent that would occur from that, what that would look like. I sort of also wonder, you know, my direct relationships, say, with my family, with my partner, with my friends, I know how they would be supportive of it. But but things such as my, you know, the Otago Polytechnic may not want to be associated with someone who is involved in direct action protests. And that's something that I wonder.
Well, I don't have. I live on my own. I'm divorced, so that's handy. I can do what I like. It depends who they are. I mean, all the people at work know, because I did get a bit of problem at work, obviously, after that. They were trying to sack me, but I managed to stay on, managed not to get sacked. But I'm now having to do shift work. I lost quite a good contract that I had, and I'm now having to do shift work in a residential service. I'm a community worker, community mental health worker.
And what the justification
and,
rationale for that was?
Well, that abandoning your work for 2 weeks because you're in prison, and actually knowingly doing an action, knowing that that might be what happened, the evidence being that I made a recording beforehand that ended up going on Facebook. That they could do that. I mean, the idea was that I would do that. It was part of the campaign. I did it for the movement. I knew it was a risk. I was hoping that my boss, who so far had been quite supportive, would continue to be so. But the lawyer for the company was a lot less supportive. She wanted to be gone. Like, she was really horrible. So I had to get my own lawyer. A friend who is a lawyer really supported me, and also the union lawyer was fantastic. And between the two of them, my job was saved. But I've had to promise not to get arrested. But I'm going to retire next year. I'll be 65, so I won't need to go to work. I'll get a pension, because I have to go to work at the moment because I haven't got any money.
There's one side to professional practice being, you know, the employer's responsibility and response to somebody doing this kind of, taking this kind of action. But another side of it is our obligations to ourselves, both to act but also to be able to do our jobs.
Yeah, totally. And within that, for someone like Jen and someone like Rosemary, they have to be true to themselves. And I understand that. I get that. It's no... They feel it is their obligation to protest, to highlight the inequity of what is occurring in our society at the moment. They feel that if they don't, then they are not being honest or true to who they are and how they operate. And that does put them at odds, A, with the majority of society, but often also with their workplaces and their work colleagues. And that's a really difficult position to be in, where that you feel that you have to take these actions, but at the same time, you're completely aware that the consequences of them, you feel, may be completely disproportionate to it. How is it that you maintain the motivation and don't burn out?
Yeah, I mean, it is... I don't know. It is difficult sometimes. You can get just fed up with it all, because it seems like whatever you do, no one's taking any notice. But then I'm really also just motivated by the other activists who are wanting to do things, especially the youngsters. I do a lot of it now in support of the youngsters, and it's okay for me. I haven't got anything to lose, really. I can get myself in trouble. No one's going to have a go at me. And but some of them, no, they can't do that because potentially in the future that's going to be a big problem for them if they get a record of some sort, you know what I mean? It might not be, but it could be. Climate activism and in generally in movements looking for for change. And I'm not sure whether that is because we've reached an age where we've become more sort of contemplative, if you like, and aware of what is around us and what harm is being done, and like being more appreciative of nature and wanting to save it or whatever, or not having anything to lose, or having less, like when the kids have left home and stuff like that, turning to a new interest, or for some people feeling responsible because we're the generation that didn't stop it, that let it happen.
Tim, you're looking at the role of anger in driving desires to make a difference and how that affects the actions you take, either as a personal person, or in your professional role. But there's so many things you could do. How do you get up in the morning and know what's the right thing to do?
Are we talking on the metaphysical level here, Sam?
It's the last question of 3 weeks.
We're pushing the conversation right out onto the edges here. I don't know. I mean, it's a bit like the, you know, that design thing, five whys. You know, if you ask the same question, ask why five times in a row, it's going to end up with your relationship with your parents in some stage. It's going to go back to that. And I think ultimately, one of the cool, fascinating things about human beings is that we're all in the same sandpit. We're just looking at it in different ways. So how do I rationalise hopping in a car and driving to work when I'm aware of the consequences that could occur versus how do I rationalise being late for work because I refuse to take a car and I'm going to walk because it has a lesser environmental footprint? And they're all trade-offs and they're all tensions and they're all things that need to be navigated and understood. And I guess one of the things that you need to be wary of is the greater the level of understanding that comes from it, the greater the willingness to throw your hands up in the air and just say, I give up, I quit. It's not worth it. It's not worth it. And whatever I do is going to be inconsequential. I can drive an electric car and then that's not going to make any differences. I can do this or I can do that. The great thing about these three conversations I've had over the 3 weeks is it reminds you that your personal actions do make a change and they are beneficial. And while it may feel inconsequential, it's not. And it's really powerful to be having conversations with people who believe that our actions can change and are of importance. And I think that's the kind of big meta takeout from the three conversations I've had with all these people, is that you need to have a level of self-belief and you need to believe that what you are doing is correct. You need to set your own compass and you need to follow it.
God, the most effective. God, I don't know. I mean, I don't think any one particular one, no, because it's not about one action that's going to bring about a big change. You know, you might start off thinking that at some stage, but it isn't. That's not how it works. It's a movement. It's every action is part of the bigger movement for change and builds on it and becomes part of it. So some might have actually ended up recruiting more. I mean, I was one of the organisers of that big march in 2015. We had about 6,000 people out in Dunedin, which is still only a fraction of what they got for the neurosurgery department or the other day for the hospital, which just goes to show when people's priorities are very specific and of their own interest, they will come out on the street. But climate activism, climate change, is just too big and too broad and too unfocused for a lot of people to think that it's worth it's, I don't know, it's worth acting on. Or maybe they think that it's just not possible. It's too big. I don't know. I mean, so those are big actions, like in the first kids, the school strike one, seemed like really amazing thing, and all the kids were there, but then everybody just like goes home, you know, they've done their bit and off they go. I personally, I'm not sure about the effectiveness of marches. Although ones that have large numbers of people turning out, like the hospital one, I really hope that will do something. Though who cares? We know the national government doesn't care about Dunedin. They don't. They don't get any votes here. They don't get any MPs here. They don't give a stuff. So, yeah, I don't know that about any particular one thing, no. I mean, basically what you're asking people to do is to kind of stand against all the norms of society that you've been used to and do something that you know is going to annoy and upset people because you think it's the right thing to do. But it is really... I don't know, I sort of thought about it. It's more than you think, unless you've tried it. See, why is it so hard? You wouldn't think it would be. But it is. It's just because you're doing something that all your life and your training so far, your social training, has told you, no, don't do that. But you're going to do it anyway.
And is that, more than anything else, the takeaway that for you to tell your students?
I think that's part of it. I think part of what I'm telling my students is I hope, is giving them a series of tools that they can take with them into the financial world, so they're not having to navigate these tensions between fiscal responsibility and ecological responsibility. That there is actually a way where the two overlap, where you can be ecologically aware and curious and still have financial viability. And I think particularly surrounding things like hospitality, restaurants, there's a role to play within that. And there's also a role to play in the education of people, of wider customers within that. So my hope is with what I'm teaching the students, with what I'm learning from these conversations, what I'm learning through my doctoral research and studies, is that these small incremental changes do add up and they are important. I mean, it wasn't that long ago that we didn't have recycling, you know. It wasn't that long ago that we had lead and petrol. And, you know, these things change, and change does come slow, and it can be frustrating with the pace of change. But the fact that it is consistent, I think, is the important bit.
Over the past 3 weeks, you have talked with Kyle Mackies and Rosemary Penwarden, and today with Jen Olson. You've described the conversations as being as if you were having a Devonshire tea. So I think we should call the series Devonshire Tea with a Side of Anger.
Excellent. Well, let's make sure it's like it's vegan cream on there. We can't have dairy cream on there. I think they'll be tipping it too far.
Well, we'd have to find out. Is Jen from Devon or from Cornwall? I can't quite tell.
The big question is, that's right.
Then it's, does the cream go on top of the anger or underneath the anger?
I think you've got the show mixed up with another one, Sam.
Who are we going out to today?
Well, I thought after 3 weeks of pretty heavy questioning, I thought we'd go with something nice and light. So the great thing about this song is, if you're listening to it, you want to test how good your speakers are. If you can hear the 16th notes being played on the hi-hat when it comes into the verse, it means you've got a very good audio system. So this is a song by a band called The National, and the song's called The Guest Room.
Yeah.
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On Air.